Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everybody, it's 11:50 p.m. Just finished recording the Breaking Point State of the Union coverage. Had a really good time with Kyle, Crystal, and Sagar. If you missed that, definitely go check out the Breaking Points page. I am dead tired, but I'm super pumped to kick off the first of the many, many, many episodes I'm going to publish on Russia and Ukraine. I think this is an issue that transcends the 8 episodes we're going to do. We were speaking of Marianne Williamson during the State of the Union coverage, and she summed up why I think this issue is so important. She specifically said, something is dying right now. The world order, the way our lives are organized, the way we approach the world, we're talking about nuclear weapons again, and the debate right now, in her words, is what comes next. And I want to look at this what comes next question through the specific lens of Ukraine. So we're going to keep publishing new episodes every single day for at least the next week or so, probably going on 2 weeks. This is going to be a huge opportunity. So if you have any questions, if you have any input, topics I should cover, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, let me know. Sagar and I are doing another Q&A reaction show tomorrow on Thursday. So if you haven't sent us anything, you can email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com, or you can leave us a comment on our Substack or leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. That always helps. Point is, our producer Phil is out of pocket right now, so I'm editing this episode myself. It's going to be very light, very straightforward. Doing this from a hotel room, so get ready for lots of episodes. And once again, you don't have to listen to every single one of them, but my overall goal here is I want people to be left with a really comprehensive view of this issue, of the stakes, where they could answer questions, figure out what we're doing, and then as we move away from the conflict, ideally, hopefully, that's what we all want, we could build the realignment to a place where we could come together and think about what these next steps are going to look like, because that's the most important thing that at least my generation has an opportunity to do right now. So for all that, let's get into the episode. This is a great conversation with Nate Sibley, a colleague of mine at Hudson Institute, around sanctions and what they can and cannot do. Also, send a tip if you like my stuff. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to The Realignment, the first day of our Ukraine daily coverage. I'm with a really great guest who I'm sure is going to be able to answer all sorts of questions that everyone is having. This is Nate Sibley. Nate is a colleague at Hudson Institute, where he studies kleptocracy, corruption, and illicit finance broadly. So obviously this has been a very, very busy week for you. I'd just love to start by just getting your initial reaction. Obviously, we're recording this on March 1st. 9 a.m. in the morning, so things can always change. But I think you're real suited to give us a big picture on how we should be seeing the economic picture here.
Sure. Well, firstly, you know, thank you so much for having me back on the show, Marshall. Although I wish it were in maybe happier or less unhappy circumstances. The past week has changed absolutely everything we think of in terms of the global security environment, the global economy, and where does one start with that? I can start from my sort of focus, which, as you say, is maybe much more on the economic side. I'm not suited to talk perhaps about the military options on the table or not on the table at the moment. So we should start by rewinding a bit, actually, just before we dive into what's happening literally every minute now in terms of those the developments in that sort of economic sphere. And just to think back to when the build-up started, when we started getting very credible warnings that Putin was seriously preparing for an invasion of Ukraine over the holiday period, over New Year, since November, really. And what sort of didn't happen then compared to what's happening now. When we think about our economic tools to deal with Russian aggression, sanctions is the first thing that springs to mind, and they are the most powerful. And we didn't do anything at that point. The Biden administration, the EU, did nothing. The path then was purely diplomacy. And so everything that we're sort of seeing happening over the past few days, I'm going to start out with the qualifier that I think it should have happened a lot earlier than that, certainly before tanks started rolling across the border.
Can we hit pause and actually talk about that point? Because I think there's an image here for folks' minds. So for our audience, which, as you know, is an audience that is probably not as hawkish as you and I are to a certain degree, there was significant debate around whether Russia would actually invade. And if they were going to invade, I think most people would say they were going to just take the breakaway separatist regions and not invade the entire country. No one, once again, within this skeptical community, could imagine a world where there'd be vacuum bombs and just civilian bombings in Kyiv. So what would punishment have looked like?
when technically speaking, aside from this type of border incursions we've seen since 2014, nothing new had happened.
But what you would have had in response to sort of heightening threat of aggression would be, that's the point at which sanctions work as deterrence, or can possibly work as deterrence. They don't always, as we know. But at that point, you would have started to take some of the steps we're doing now. So you would have started to sanction Russian financial institutions. You might not have done a full sweep, full blocking, which we still haven't done. You might have started to sanction some of the non-financial and energy-related trade that Russia has, which is not as critical to it, but still makes up some 40% of its exports. So you could start to stagger that stuff and start to turn, demonstrate resolve that you understand the situation, what is going on. And that's even in response just to what we all thought was going to happen, as you say, which would have been a sort of more limited attempt to permanently seize the eastern regions of Ukraine. That none of that happened. We were stuck in a sort of cycle of diplomacy. All the while, Putin was sort of building up his forces. I mean, I think, before we go on, mea culpa and everything, I think everyone in the foreign policy community, think tanks on the Hill and so on and so forth, needs to sort of take a step back and look back. I mean, we're in the thick of it at the moment, but the warning signs have actually been there for quite some time. And we were so used to dealing with the world in the sort of, I don't like the word paradigm, we were so used to dealing with the environment we've been dealing with for the past few decades that we didn't see that the leader of a world power was becoming increasingly unhinged. This thing he published several months ago, this crazy ahistorical screed about Russia and Ukraine being the same people, but actually goes into weird medieval history reasons for that and stuff. These strange pictures of him over Christmas, sort of on his own, sort of weeping in an Orthodox chapel. The long tables is absolutely petrified of COVID. This is a regime that has transformed far beyond what we were dealing with over the past sort of decades. In the past few years, it's moved from what it started out as, a kind of oligarchy when Putin was rising to power. That's why we talk about the oligarchs. They're kind of gone now in terms of them being oligarchs, in terms of what that means is that a group of people, who can exert influence over a country and how it's governed. He's totally tamed the ball.
What do you mean by they're gone? You said they're gone. What do you mean by that?
They're not gone. Well, some of them are gone. So, this is a good place to start, actually, even before we get to, we're sort of rewinding as we go forward. So we need to look at what's happened to Russia to understand the way it's being governed and Putin's behavior right now. Putin was propelled to power by a group of certainly close-knit sort of friends that became the oligarchs, the Deripaskas, the Abramoviches of this world, coming up through the sort of security services, links to organized crime, all that sort of murky stuff. And that's why in its first decade, Russia became a cowboy kleptocracy style. Putin's bargain with the Russian people was that things will be stable compared to the 1990s when they had another financial crisis and things just, the other run on the ruble and everything. And he maintained that. But what he also did, and the way he did that, was he allowed his sort of frenemies, the oligarchs, to divvy up Russia's economy, the major sectors. The deal was they were allowed to steal as much as they wanted, as long as they did not challenge him in politics. What he's done over the past, maybe, and that sort of was the case for a while. And when you hear calls at the moment to go after Putin's personal wealth, go after the oligarchs, people are dealing with that world in which if we seize their assets, they suddenly organize a palace coup against Putin. We were ignoring what has happened over the past at least 5-6 years, whereby Putin has progressively eliminated any form of, certainly in broader Russia, democratic opposition and free media, independent media. But within his own power base, he has eliminated any sort of rivalry or even influence over him. So the oligarchs, is why when you see the past week, one would expect the oligarchs whose interests are being shattered right now to speak out and say and organize a palace coup and remove this guy. He's acting like a madman. He's destroyed Russia's economy and our personal finance. And what you've got, these sort of whimpers, I hope the war stops. That's kind of like the only thing they feel comfortable and safe phrasing. When we saw last week, Putin summoned the so-called oligarchs to a meeting at the Kremlin. It was the day after he decided to invade. And he treated them less disdainfully than he did his immediate advisors, who are the so-called sort of Siloviki, who came up through the sort of security intelligence world, who he had berated in a similar meeting the day before. But he basically listened to them respectfully, but they were being informed after the event, Russia's entire business leadership community. And so what he's replaced these oligarchs, so he spent those sort of first 10 years wrestling with the oligarchs who did pose a political challenge to him at the time and could have organized palace coups and factions to replace him and whatnot. Through process of political maneuvering, imprisonment, exile, and of course, assassination, he has removed anyone who could possibly pose a challenge to him. And what he's replaced them with within the Kremlin are these, the primary factions, this is called the Siloviki, the strong men that rose with him through organizations like the KGB, Russia's security apparatus. They are hardliners, but they're strong men, but they're also yes men. They're not there to give Putin advice. They're there to enact his will. And they are less internationally exposed than the oligarchs. They often wear, most of them under sanctions at this point. They laugh it off. They proudly declare it every opportunity they can as a sign of loyalty to Putin.
So what's happened? You keep saying so many things that I frankly didn't really know. I'm going to have to keep interrupting you. Apologies. But What has happened to the oligarchs in the past week then? So you're saying the oligarchs are suffering these catastrophic financial consequences. Yet to your point, we're seeing whimpers. I'm seeing two oligarchs say, hey, like peace, maybe, what's actually happened to them this week?
So they've been, they've also been grappling, I think, perhaps with the realization that they are no longer in an oligarchy. They are in a personalist dictatorship, the most extreme form of authoritarian governance. There is only one man calling the shots in Russia right now. No one is advising him. He's sat on his own. And the consequences for them, they have enjoyed the jet-setting lifestyle around the world. They have huge business interests overseas. They wanted to be able to move freely between their privileges within Russia's hierarchy at home and all the creature comforts of the West. What they're doing is flying around manically on their private jets. Some of them are back in Russia. Some of them are like flying in and out of Russia. And the reason we know this is because it's actually quite easy to track where their private jets are going. Now, you have to take it with a pinch of salt. We don't know they're on them. They know we can see them. So are they sending them around to confuse people who might be trying to arrest them or whatever? There's not much to tell of what the oligarchs have done. Some of them occupy, so some of the sort of old big swinging oligarchs, they still occupy positions of importance within the Russian state. For example, Peter Arvin, he's head of one of the biggest banks there. So there's a bunch of them that are still in charge of like the big banks, the biggest energy companies. Some of them sort of their main stuff is overseas now. And so some of them are sort of being summoned to the Kremlin along with the rest of the business leadership. Some of them are flying back to take part in, I guess, urgent discussions they've sort of been summoned back. We don't really know is the honest answer. We've never really known what those conversations look like between Putin and his closest sort of power brokers. Are they his power brokers anymore? I don't think so. I think they're being ordered around like headless chickens and they don't know where to turn. As you said, we've had no major condemnation of Putin from any of the major oligarchs. Deripaska, who are the other ones? I can't remember what I'm saying. Sorry, it's been a busy morning. But Mikhail Friedman, for example, they've come out with statements saying that the war really needs to stop. We just think it really needs to stop, and it kind of full stop there. An interesting, Max Seddon at the Financial Times published something, someone had been able to speak to Mikhail Friedman about this. Mikhail Friedman is one of the big sort of older sort of oligarchs who survived all this and is one of Putin's guys, if you know what I mean, is Putin's people. And he sort of said, look, I think the war's horrifying, but what do you expect me to do? I have people in Russia. If I speak out, that puts them in danger. So he's almost sort of explicitly saying, I want to speak out, but I can't because I'm so frightened, and I respect Putin's power to be able to go after my people in my organization and imprison them or kill them or whatever.
I want to hit something that you said. We'll gradually get to the today point here, don't worry. So if this is no longer a oligarchy where Putin rules with the oligarchs and once again, this is a super simplistic summation, but if you asked the conventional wisdom in 2008, it would basically look somewhat like that.
Yeah, and they would
that was what 2008 was. But if in 2022, you are saying that Russia is a personalized dictatorship around an increasingly erratic Vladimir Putin, how would sanctions have served as the deterrent then?
Well, so this moves us on. So what you'll see is many people like me, I've at least had a real awakening, and I hope others who work in the kleptocracy and sort of world, small as that is, will have the same thing. Is in one of the calls you'll see is go after Putin's wallets. The wallets are the people who hold his supposed personal wealth in trust. And his personal wealth has been estimated, anywhere between $120 and $200 billion. I have no idea what those figures mean. And to me, they're personally, I know who brought them up and I have huge respect for them. They're far cleverer people than me. But they're useless and they're meaningless in the current environment. Putin is not.
Yeah.
Because Putin is no longer a kleptocrat in the sense that he was for the first sort of maybe even 15 years of his rule. He has no personal ambition. He's not, look at the way he's behaving. This is not a man who wants to, who is planning to retire, you know, to Saint-Tropez, sit around drinking cocktails in his Hawaiian shirt with his mistresses hanging off him, which is what we always think of as like oligarchs kind of like wanting the end game to be, right? This is a man who sees himself as like, you know, Peter II reincarnated, bringing Russia back to greatness. And he's all about regime survival and legacy. So the idea by when you hear people say go after Putin's wealth and go after his oligarchs, what they're saying is either, you know, we managed to find this supposed 200 billion that Putin owns, quote unquote, and that he's counting on to fund a peaceful retirement. We seize it and overnight he turns into dust, you know, like a vampire or something, because this private wealth is a magical source of sustenance for him. The other thing, which is slightly more credible, and we'll get onto it, but is, you know, if you go after his oligarchs' wealth, can they exert political pressure on him or even remove him, you know, because they're scared of their interests, him no longer protecting their interests? That is something that we can investigate, and we can talk about that in a minute. But the idea that, you know, that Putin is sort of, you were asking about, so what in that scenario, what value do sanctions have?
Because I want to set this up the right way, because like you're saying, I completely understand your point around Putin is not driven by the Ferrari Lamborghini. He's not a tin pot Cold War dictator from post-colonial Africa. That's our image, but that isn't what we're dealing with here. Mm-hmm. Therefore, even if you could magically handle the money, he owns the Russian state, right? Exactly. So if within this framework, so it seems like, so the point of my question was, well, if he doesn't care about money in the traditional sense, why would any type of economic sanctions before the invasion, as you said, was the policy you prefer, have adjusted his decision-making if this is all from his head, from his mind, to the battlefield?
So you move on from, so sanctions as a deterrent to sanctions as like sort of operationally inhibiting his ability to finance it. In that mindset, which I was in, you know, like the Putin we'd been dealing with for the past, you know, even since, you know, 2014, occasionally appearing as a kind of rational actor on the world stage, one would think he would be responsive to escalating sanctions, only against his oligarchs and his chief advisors, but against the Russian economy more broadly. We now know he's sort of like thinks he has this heaven sent mission to retake Ukraine. That probably would not have intimidated him. So taking a step back and what you're drawing out, what can the purpose of sanctions be? If not deterrence, then it has to be, operationally, as I said, like inhibiting his ability to actually make war on Ukraine. And I think there are sort of maybe sort of three sort of priorities that we can think about here. So how do you sort of help Ukraine? And that's the top one. And the way to do that is would have been to impose on Russia the kind of sanctions that you've seen in the past week after the invasion, before the invasion. What you want, because if, so it's, sorry, it's a bit complicated, but if Russia's oligarchs are no longer capable of calling the shots for Putin, what are our options left economically for influencing his behavior? And to my mind, it is running Russia's economy so badly into the ground that he faces either a palace coup from the security services that he's surrounded him with, or the Russian people are so fed up, as they are about to find out they're going to be, by the measures that have been imposed on them, that they you know, take to the streets and storm the Kremlin themselves. It's not, you know, the options aren't great, and they're kind of a long shot, but that's kind of what you're left with. The other thing is simply like his ability to acquire, you know, the raw materials, the financing he needs to actually just run a war for that long. The idea in the run-up to this, and everyone was sort of frightened of, was that he had, since 2014, he's been amassing kind of a war chest of foreign exchange reserves, around $630 billion. But about 40% of that was in euros and dollars combined. And so what the effect of these sanctions in the past week have been is to basically cut off, you know, that 40%, to freeze all those assets that were outside Russia. So 40% of his war chest is now gone. Funding the war costs him billions of dollars every day. The knock-on effect is actually more than that, because when you take the sort of devastating step of quite strong sanctions against the central bank, that obviously knocks investor confidence. There's a run on the ruble, and we've seen what we've seen in the past, 24 hours, which is Russians queuing to try and get cash out and finding that the ATMs are just empty. You know, inflation sort of starts to surge. The central bank has to step in with increased interest rates. Putin has taken the extraordinary step of like banning any like convertibility of the ruble to outside stuff. He's basically said he's turning Russia into something approaching an autarky, which again speaks to his, you know.
And what is, and what does autarky mean?
It is a completely self-contained economy. So he's cutting Russia off. We thought this is what we're dealing with. So we thought cutting Russia off from the financial system, or trying to, or starting to, would intimidate him, would perhaps affect his ability to do things. He just went a step further that he didn't need to do, and basically said, you're not converting. He's locked off any ability. He's sort of imposing his own sanctions on Western companies that have investments in Russia. So you've seen sort of BP and Shell, the big oil companies, extraordinary, trying to ditch their sort of 30% shares in Russia's biggest energy companies. And they can't, because they've said they're going to do it. But at the same second, Vladimir Putin banned basically the stock market hasn't opened for a second day, and he's banned foreign companies from selling their shares in Russian companies. He's banned the ruble being converted into any other currency. The effects of those, it gets pretty technical, and quite, to be honest, I don't come from a sort of like financial trading background, so I'm still figuring out the sort of weeds of it. But you know, the thrust is he's faced with financial isolation by the West. He said thank you, and he has doubled down on it and appears to be further isolating Russia. So how this plays out for him is just, you know, we can talk about that in a minute, perhaps. It's really extraordinary. Well, again, not a man who plans on retiring to Saint-Tropez anytime soon. He knows he's going to die in Russia, either by old age or some bullets in his back. These are the actions of someone with that kind of resolve.
And something that we've done here is we've talked about Russia in the context of Putin. We've talked about the oligarchs. We've hit on the military political apparatus. Talk more about the Russian people and the impact of sanctions on them, because you're seeing this interesting discourse on Twitter right now where people are pointing out the fact that there seems to be a total media blackout on Russia. Yeah. So it's unclear that the populace really knows what's going on. Obviously there are peace protests, but there's a very justifiable case to be made that there's a total disconnect between, once again, the vacuum bombs, the serious war crimes that are happening in Ukraine right now, and the everyday information experience for Russian citizens. So how does that, what is happening to them right now? And then if they don't know what's happening at a large scale, it doesn't seem to me that there's a ability to hope that they go overthrow the Kremlin, because if they don't see the tie between Putin's actions and what's happening in Ukraine and their cutting off of the global financial system, to me, it will just feel like a bit of Western aggression that actually fuels Putin's arguments. What's your reaction to that?
No, totally. That's something I've been wrestling with over the past few hours. So I don't think sanctioning the oligarchs is going to bring about the palace coup we need, for reasons we explained. So we move on to, will broader economic sanctions provoke a palace coup or an uprising by, you know, the Russian people sufficient to topple Putin or at least stop him in his tracks? And you're quite right. They don't have anything approaching access to reality. The internet is severely limited. They're fed state news. I've no doubt, I haven't seen it myself, but I'm sure that, you know, the lines outside ATMs, the hardships they are now facing will be presented purely as an act of Western aggression against the Russian people. Of course, they're not. We need to sort of, probably should start out with what sanctions actually are. They're simply the United States, the EU and allies saying, we don't like what you're doing in Ukraine, and we're not going to allow you to use our currency to do it. It's not an aggressive action. It's not financial warfare in the sense of if we hacked one of their banks and removed all the currency or released all their financial, that would be an aggressive act of financial warfare. That would be a cyber attack, right? Sanctions are just saying, no, you can't use our currency to do what you're doing at the moment. We don't like you anymore. And that's all they are. But they will be presented at your point as Western aggression. So this is why I warn everyone, sanctions are not going to be the answer to the Ukraine war overnight. It will take time for Russians, however they come to this, but the isolation from the global economy that is coming for them, the hardship that they are going to have to endure because of this, it is coming, and it might take weeks or months, but at some point they're going to have to ask, well, if this is an act of Western aggression even, and I completely believe all that, why don't we have a government that's able to stand up to them or, you know, is doing something about it? At some point there must come some level of desperation that will cause, you know, a broader number of people to sort of take to the streets on this. We've already seen protests across Russia. They're not sort of completely cut off. People who want to see news from the outside, there are ways of doing that for them. The problem is that we're dealing with 15 plus years of just propaganda, intensifying propaganda, and a shrinking independent media space. And you're quite right, the prospects are bleak. I don't think a few lines outside ATM machines are suddenly going to get people to go and face down the brutality of the Russian police state that this overnight. But, you know, you've got to think eventually they're not going to be able to feed their children, stuff like that. The hardship is coming for them. And I wish it were not so. But, you know, sadly, the Russian people have moved down our kind of hierarchy of victims, so to speak, in view of, you know, what's being inflicted on Ukraine at the moment. So no, I don't have good news for you there either. And it's something I've been thinking about, how you might accelerate that process.
Another topic that isn't going to give any of us good news. I'd like you to help us as an audience think through the prevention punishment dynamic, mm-hmm. because I've never got as much just general audience response to any topic as this one. High school friends, audience just emailing in, and the very clear consensus now that this has been done has been, I know we can't send airstrikes in. I know we can't do, nor do we want to do those considering just the nuclear issue, but mm-hmm. I wish we can do something.
Yeah.
And I personally, to say my biases or preferences, I want Russia to pay for what they're doing. If you just ask me point blank, Marshall, what do you want? I want, so long as Putin is president of Russia, I want Russia to be completely excluded from the mm-hmm. global financial system.
Yep.
Now that I said that bias, though, and that's in a very emotional, maybe that could be a good policy, but that is my emotional reaction. Mm-hmm. Because I know we can't send in NATO forces to help the Ukrainians, I want to punish to the maximum extent we can. But if I'm honest with myself, I have to admit that I am not coming up with that formulation from an empirical perspective. So I'm not saying, okay, how do we make sure that this doesn't extend to Poland? How do we make sure that Belarus doesn't so Kazakhstan backed down from joining Putin's coalition, but how do we make sure that Kazakhstan doesn't join as well too? So how do we balance just the and this is a philosophical, this isn't like a policy, just how do you think of balancing this urge to punish with this policy should serve specific aims bit? Because I don't know how to do it, to be honest.
Well, it's an interesting debate, and to the whole thing about our sanctions, financial warfare, to punish our enemies. The purpose of sanctions, in my mind, should never be to sort of punish anyone, but to try and affect outcomes. And they're not the best. They don't have a great track record of doing that. But they've never been applied in the way to at least a sort of economically advanced country the way they are to Russia at the moment. And so to my mind, it's not about punishing.
Sorry, because that's an important... There is a lot of history that you just dropped there that I want to actually unpack for a second. What do you mean? So are you saying that traditionally sanctions have been applied to autarkic cutoff? Like, so it's Iraq, it's Iran to a certain degree, it's North Korea, yes. Obviously, it's Cuba. Has there just never been a modern, industrialized, globalized, up until last week, state that's had this level of sanctions applied? Is that correct? Is that what
you're saying? Yeah, it's the culmination of, you know, Russia being, you know, a vast economy. You'll hear people say, oh, don't worry about Russia. Its economy is the size of Italy's. It's a gas station with a gift shop that's a front for a money laundering ring. It's not, we all know now it is important because it's not just the size, it's not just the GDP, it's what that economy is, And it's in the and it's focused on the two most strategically important, it's energy and finance. Those are Russia's two strong points. And that's why they were able to hold, why they were able to blackmail and still blackmail Europe over this, right? So when we talk about sort of like the other countries that have faced, you know, these sorts of what, you know, the Trump administration called maximum pressure campaigns, Venezuela, North Korea, Iran, to a slightly lesser extent, because they still sort of, the Europeans still try to work with them a bit, I guess. But none of them are one of the three sort of major nuclear armed big powers of the world. So this is unprecedented. Well, and none of them have faced the kind of international unity in that response. And the US controls the world, the global reserve currency, the dollar. So it has a unique ability to use sanctions and law enforcement and all sorts of things. Its jurisdiction spreads worldwide because of the power and ubiquity of the US dollar. But it's incredible. And we've not been used to being able to use that alongside the euro. And the British pound. And so to have them along is, you know, pretty incredible. And the Biden administration does deserve some credit, I suppose, you know, in terms of, that's the one thing it's done well in this, I think, is sort of dealing with allies and building that coalition. But yeah, no, this is unprecedented, Marshall. Like there's never been anything like this, to answer your question. And it's not over yet. There's still plenty of room for escalation in terms of what we do to isolate Russia.
And I interrupted you, and apologies. Do you remember what you were saying?
We were talking about what are sanctions kind of for in the foreseeable future. Deterrence, punishment. To my mind, punishment isn't a good framing of it, because it does imply that we're using economic aggression. We're not. We're simply saying we don't support your policy, your aggression towards Ukraine or any other policy of any other country that we impose sanctions on around the world. And we're not going to let you use our currency to do it. So the purpose of, you know, what we need to be looking at in the coming days and months is that there is still plenty of room for escalation with Russia. Most notably, we have not touched their energy exports yet. In fact, the banks were given, you know, a license to be able to still provide payments to energy companies in Russia. So that's bringing in, I think it's like $50-60 billion. I think it was a day or something like that. No, it can't be that, but I was reading earlier. Sorry, I'm in a bit of a muddle at the moment. I'm mixing up my figures. But that is what is now probably going to be the main source for Putin's ability to fund what is going on in Ukraine and to keep some sort of economic order in Russia in as much as he can. And so, you know, that would be the kind of the next thing to do. I still wouldn't consider any of that to be punishing Russia. I consider that to be taking preemptive actions to prevent Russia's ability to escalate the situation in Ukraine and to perhaps attack other countries in the region. Putin has proved that he is not a rational or reliable actor anymore. You know, unspoken US policy must now be for him to go, or for him to be replaced in some way, even if not in person, but in fact, in terms of power.
What do you mean by unspoken policy?
Well, we can't say we want regime and change in Russia. That's tantamount to a declaration of, you know, war. You can't, the president can't stand there and say, he can say, I think President Putin should stand aside for the good of Russia, but he can't say every action the United States is about to take is to topple Vladimir Putin. That's regime change, that's an existential threat. And that's one of the circumstances under which, by way, Russia is allowed to use, as said, you know, its own rules say it's allowed to use nuclear weapons. We can keep saying is, this is no longer a reliable actor, it's an extremely dangerous actor, and we will be taking every step possible to curtail its ability to fund malign and dangerous operations outside its own borders, including the war in Ukraine, but any further actions it might take that spill on in the future. So everything we do from now on, it should be preventing Russia from maintaining its capacity to cause mischief outside its own borders. And so that's the sort of correct framing of it, I think. It's not about pressure. Because the other issue is, right, as I said, they've moved down the victim hierarchy, sadly. But if we get into sort of rhetoric about, you know, punishing the Russian people and all the rest of it, punishing Russia, we talk about anything apart from the Putin regime, Putin himself, you know, that they are going to come in for some economic hardship, and they have been spoon-fed all this stuff about this being the West's fault already. We are setting up ourselves, even if there is a regime change in Russia as a result, there's a palace coup or something, the Russian people are still going to hate us because they couldn't get baby food. They couldn't, you know, fill up their car and they lost their job. Like they have been told to think this is the West's fault. And so unless we have some miracle and it is a sort of pro-Western or, you know, at least a kind of reasonable, we're not going to get an amazing democratic transition where Alexei Navalny is broken out and leads a kind of march on the Kremlin and all the rest of it. But hopefully we can get some leader who's, you know, understands that kind of thing is not in Russia's interests anymore. But in that being the case, he will still be up against the opinion of the Russian people, who do not have not been been dealing with reality for the past, you know, 10 years.
It's interesting because a debate that a lot of people saw very seriously was the debate over banning Russians from American universities. Mm. So how do you think of those sorts of debates when it comes to, so just what's your reaction to that debate that was happening a little? It seems as if that issue has just died down, but what was your reaction to it? How should, when these, as things continue to escalate, mm-hmm. those debates are going to continue on and on and on and on. Yeah. How should we think about them when they happen?
I think, you know, our measures should be targeted at the Russian, should be dealing with the Russian government. We should do everything possible to avoid. It's understandable. It's an emotional, really emotional situation. Even like within the 24 hours, I supported all that stuff. Cooler heads must prevail on that stuff. We do not want to do anything that alienates the Russian people. That's very hard for Ukrainian friends to hear right now. I'm talking about the Russian people. And when we talk about banning them from working in our universities, from traveling to the West, from studying here, or even arguably from being able to keep their assets out of the clutches of Vladimir Putin's regime, his kleptocratic regime. That's not an argument I agree with, that last one. But when we cut off access to the West, that only sort of like keeps them in under Putin's thumb. They don't get access. At the moment, there is a chance they get access to other views and our way of, with our perspective on things. If we just force every Russian back and we start treating them in a discriminatory way, there is a danger that can just stoke their sort of hatred of us in the long run and just further contribute to a fortress Russia and actually empower Putin's way of dealing with things.
I know people hate counterfactuals, but everything you're saying is making me wonder something. So my framework for approaching this issue has been Putin, the oligarchs, the military. Obviously, Putin has the moral responsibility for making these decisions, but these are roughly aligned groups who are pursuing these aggressive policies against the West. Mm-hmm. It seems, though, that we've discovered, especially given your framework around the way the oligarchy works now, the oligarchs actually had a pretty great deal in the status quo before all this. Yep. You obviously worked on kleptocracy, so you personally did not like that status quo for mm-hmm. them. But from their mm-hmm. perspective, they had their money, they're owning their soccer teams, they're sending their kids to US universities, travel, all of the, once again, as you said, Putin isn't driven by Saint-Tropez, but there are plenty of people in Russian society who were.
Yep.
Is there anything we could have done to, I don't want to even say bolster the oligarchs, because that's not quite the right framing here, but it mm-hmm. seems like something we've lost between the transition from the 2000s to the 2020s is we've mm-hmm. just lost another part of Russian society that could have been bargained with, that could have been a restraining force on Putin. Because I'm just thinking out loud here, but I'm just really realizing, wow. Ooh. We actually, in a weird way, we actually had a lot. If because here's what I want with Ukraine. I want the world to look the way it looked. I've given up on 2014. I've given up on the breakaway provinces. Like a lot of people, there are a lot of traitors there. I've just given up on that. I want things to look the way they looked last Monday.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the oligarchs weren't that too. Yeah. And from what you're saying, that means that we may disagree on kleptocracy. We may disagree on all sorts of things. There was a shared East-West interest there. And I don't know. Do you have any reaction to this? Once again, there's no point in question here.
And that's why countering corruption and kleptocracy, I keep telling people, keep asking me, like, what can we do? How do we go after the Russian oligarchs? I'm like, no, this is countering corruption and kleptocracy. It's a preemptive thing. It's something we should be doing anyway in peacetime. It's not something to do after the tanks start rolling. It's too late, as we've been discussing that. So yeah, you're right. Russia's elite had an absolute interest and enjoyed all the creature comforts of the West. At the same time, though, you need to remember they were active members of Vladimir Putin's regime. They were propping him up. They were buying football clubs and making strategic investments and sending money back to Russia and doing his bidding. And at home, they don't just do business outside the West. They have, you know, they own media stations back in Russia and all the rest of it. They are part of his regime. Okay, they're not people we should have considered friends at any point. And to that end, the time to put pressure on them and to get them angry and start talking about palace coups and things like that with each other, it was before all this happened, probably before 2014, frankly. But during that time, we continued to vaunt them. They continued to swan around in high society in New York and London, fund universities and art galleries and all the rest of it. And we encouraged them, that side of things. By the time our interests have truly aligned, they have been effectively neutered as a force, a political force in Russia. And they're now, some of them are literally probably trapped within the Kremlin or in a cabin in the woods somewhere in the Urals or something like that. There is captive to Putin's regime, possibly as the average Russian citizen. That's not to say they don't have any sway anymore. I don't know. We do not know is the honest answer, whether if they talk to each other, the oligarchs could still, there's still a faction that could do something like that. I will say they're not the ones with their fingers on the buttons in the Kremlin. That is this group, you hear about them called the Siloviki, who are the sort of Putin's security, intelligence, military inner circle, who are strong men, but yes men, as I said, they're not. There is people, they'll sort of like back into the hill, unless things get so bad that their own faction's survival is threatened. And then that's kind of our best hope is honestly at the back of my mind and where I'm at the moment. It's just that some, you know, Siloviki general decides he's had enough, pulls one of the guards' guns away and puts a few bullets in Putin in a backroom meeting or something. But sadly, I think that's probably our best hope at the moment.
Nate, we need at least one moment of levity during this episode. And first question on that, you're an American citizen, correct?
I am, yes, as of November last year.
I asked this because you very pointedly referred to soccer as football when I referred to soccer clubs. No, it's okay. So I just want to ask you, I want to know the answer to this question. How do you, this is totally unrelated. This is a biographical question. How do you think of like Anglicisms now that you're an American citizen? Do you find yourself thinking, I should say soccer? I don't need to say football. You know, how do you think of that?
Well, it depends on your emotional, I've been thinking, this is on my mind a lot. Then it depends on, you know, the amount that I use the word. Is it complete? I don't in principle like to change the way I talk just because of, you know, it's how I grew up, right? but at some point, if I keep talking about lifts instead of elevators, bins instead of trash cans, people just have a blank, what are you talking about? And so you do have to adopt a lot of those things. That's just, you know, part of it. There are some things to which you have an emotional attachment, which I will never, you know, I will remain culturally British. And so-called soccer is one of those, you know, it's football. I'm sorry. I'm never going to, you know, even I'm a dual citizen. So this is a, you know, competing influences in my mind. But it's always going to be football for me, I'm afraid.
That's a great rubric because bins would be a bit pretentious. I would shake the audience would shake their heads at bins. Have you ever watched 30 Rock?
Yes.
Martin Sheen's character, who is my velocipede, and just his character is obviously this is in season four. So yeah, we can agree. I give you permission in this context. Football's okay. Bins are completely forbidden. So okay, back to the regularly scheduled programming. I actually, this is a note to the audience. I'm not kidding. This is an incredibly depressing conversation. So I actually needed a break. Okay, so our researcher extraordinaire Aaron Visser has written some really great questions for you. So just his last second, I'd like not quick answers, but just like, you know, just I'm just going to ask you these questions from the sheet. Audience will appreciate them. For example, question one from Aaron: does issuing a sanction remove leverage? Every sanction issued is one that can't be threatened. So does it make sense to hold some bullets in reserve, considering what's happening right now?
No, we've crossed the line where that is what we should have been doing over the new year when we were escalating. That's when we should have told him we still had things in reserve to hit you with. Your life is going to get worse. Now he has totally crossed the line. The purpose of sanctions is no longer deterrence and retaining a bit of leverage to threaten him with. The purpose of sanctions now should be to cripple his economy and remove him from power.
And you've alluded to this question, but I still want to ask it to get a clear articulation. When do sanctions work? When do they fail? And what kind of sanctions tend to be the most effective?
Well, sanctions is a huge refers to a huge broad range of things we can do. So, you know, from full blocking sanctions is what most people think, which is what we haven't actually done, even on the central bank or anything else yet. That's just chopping institutions off, ranging to more subtle things. For example, when we were dealing with oligarchs, sometimes the sanctions will not allow them to receive a dividend from a shareholding they have in a company. So little things as scalpel-like and as subtle as that. When do they work and when they don't? I think we should not overstate their ability to affect conduct. You know, and that, this is a good example. I think by shattering Russia's economy in time, we might have just physically prevented Russia from having the resources to mobilize to invade Ukraine, perhaps. But it would not have affected Putin's intentions. Okay, like, and you look at Iran as well. We want to stop them building a nuclear weapon, which is their overriding strategic objective in the Middle East. It has not stopped them trying. Maduro regime. We want to topple Maduro. Well, it hasn't toppled Maduro. So we shouldn't overstate them. We need to look at them. I think they work best when we treat them as what they are, which is defensive measures. And that might sound strange because all the talk at the moment is about aggression, using the West using its financial nuclear bomb, which I think is a very irresponsible way to talk about it. No, this is just simply saying we don't want your money. We don't want you tinting our currency. We don't want your money in our economies. And when we approach it like that, we can start to use them more effectively, I think.
Next question. And you said you weren't happy with Biden's policy, but I'll ask you this specifically from Aaron. How would you rate the Biden administration's handling of the crisis?
Well, I want my president to do the right thing, do it well. But I think when we look back on this with the benefit of and watching the way that the European Union came on board and the Biden administration now letting them take the lead is unthinkable. So they have, you know, been part of a what I hope in the long term will be a beneficial restructuring of global and European security environment, so that we can say that for them. I would give them very poor rating overall. I think we should have been the time for escalatory sanctions, where we do those things, we start to shut the Russian economy off in increments, was earlier this year. As I said, we all have mea culpa. We were not scared, all of us, in the way that we should have been, and pushing them to do that, perhaps, I think. And the second tank, all this stuff should have, when it became clear that Putin was going to invade, even if we thought it was going to be those limited Eastern Ukrainian provinces, that was the time to bring on full sanctions by the US and work with the EU to bring them online doing the same. But that was the time for US leadership on this. And I think the US is now actually falling behind the EU in terms of its sanctions and the economic response.
So two last questions. I was about to refer to you jokingly as half European because of your British citizenship. But then I thought, well, aside from being a little uncouth, actually, Britain's not even a part of the EU anymore. So are you European?
One of the, I voted to remain in the EU. I see the benefit. I was never a Ramona, as they say, though. I was never someone, the vote hadn't been taken. I was like, let's get on with it, make the best of it. But one of the reasons being, I don't think, you know, the EU has been around for a few decades. It's a political institution. It's not the region itself. Being an EU citizen is not the same as being a European, and British people, by virtue of the location of our little lump of rock, will always be European unless someone manages to blast it out to the other side of the Atlantic. So yes, I do think of myself as European is the short answer.
So then let's get to what you were alleging. What do you, so you're talking about what can be built out of this. What do you think a proper European security and financial infrastructure could look like?
Well, that just hasn't been one, for the past few decades. They've totally relied on the US to provide their security guarantees. They failed when we talk about the economic security side of things, which is much more my area. They've not lifted a finger. It's the US that's totally led on the sanctions and other financial measures against not only Russia, but Iran, Venezuela, all the rest of them. And one would hope that Europe is finding its voice and its resolve on these issues. And that looking, you know, Russia is obviously the immediate problem, but when we look to other problematic regimes, like North Korea, like China, like Iran, they will have maybe a tougher time convincing Europeans that they don't deserve to be hit with the full gamut of Western deterrence from the various things that they're up to. The Europeans in particular, they just don't have the same, they don't have things like, they're getting them now because of the threat of China, but they don't have things like the Committee on Financial Investment in the US, which vets foreign investments for national security threats. We don't let Russia buy American defense contractors. We don't let Russia, we don't let China build nuclear plants in the middle of, you know, Ohio or something. Those things were not in place in Europe. They were, you know, they were much more easily influenced and infiltrated by foreign money. I don't mean necessarily corruption like bribes. I just mean the weight of that. So what I'm hoping is that the European population as well is much more aware of the sort of, it's simplistic to divide the world into democracy versus autocracy, but that's kind of where the chips are falling.
It's directionally, I think it's directionally accurate, in terms of how the alliances are stoking out, especially with Belarus joining. Well, so last question here, and I know that this is a difficult one to answer because most of what you focus on, as you've articulated, is best done before there are vacuum bombs going off in civilian populations. As of 10:28 a.m. on March 1st, what, given your space, should be done?
There should immediately be full blocking. I have this ready to go because I know exactly what I want. There should immediately be full blocking sanctions, which are not at the moment, despite the way it's been presented, against Russia's central bank and all of Russia's financial institutions, not just, you know, like the five or six biggest ones, which is where we're at the moment. And some of those aren't even fully blocked. We need to lock Russia's financial system away. We should then expand sanctions to that 40% of trade that I mentioned earlier on. And this is something that our colleague at Hudson Marshall Billingsley has been very astute about. These are things like metals, sort of chemicals, machine equipment. Those do not have, with some exceptions related to sort of Russia's military industries, those do not have sanctions on them at the moment. I think we should be accelerating Russia's Putin. It sounds strange because what we've been talking about is Putin wants to turn this into an autarky now. He's hell-bent on that. But at some point, that will become unbearable for the Russian people. And at some point, his ability, his physical capability to conduct military operations of the scale that we've seen against Ukraine or other, you know, misadventures will be inhibited by the fact that he has turned his country into a basket case. So we need to proceed with those with all you know, those should have been on the second tanks. All of those should have been on the second tanks crossed into Ukraine, in my view.
Well, Nate, this was, like I said, our first day of almost daily Ukraine coverage. We're not starting on a really positive note in any way whatsoever, but I really appreciate you coming on. And I think that, you know, the audience, left, right, and center is going to get a kick out of your perspective here. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I hope to come back in, you know, less tragic circumstances. Thanks for having me.